It's not going to make me very popular, but I'm used to that. No smoking in this hall. I've waited and delayed as long as I could, but I have no excuse now. So please, until you leave this hall, no more smoking. I'm Kitty Strickland, and I'm an alcoholic. I have a very pleasant duty today, but first of all, I'm going to make a few announcements. We have a pair of glasses that was found somewhere here. If any of you know who owns them, please claim them. If you hear that anybody has lost them and they're not claimed after the meeting, I will take them over to Stanton Hall. The other announcement is, for the evening dinner, anyone holding chuckery tickets for tonight's dinner, please go to the faculty dining room. Otherwise, you're not getting any dinner. Another announcement, if anyone knows Sigmund Jastrzemski, have him come to the message center. One other announcement, girls. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of the press, radio, and film. If there is anyone in this room who had not heard that before, please take heed. This meeting is being taped, and cassettes will be available. The university does not permit that we do any personal taping. Please try to comply. That's the end of the announcement. Today, we bring you a lady who wears many hats. For all of her professional life, she has been in the field of public health. She has been affiliated with the National Council on Alcoholism. She is on the New Jersey Governor's Task Force on Alcohol and Alcohol Abuse and lectures at the Rutgers School of Alcohol Studies. She serves many capacities, either as a teacher or a consultant in the field of alcoholism. But today the hat she is wearing is that which we all wear. We as women alcoholics and as members of Alcoholics Anonymous. During the last 6 years, I have been privileged. While I lived for a while in the East, and when I visit New Jersey now, to attend a luncheon that Jerry Delaney permits women alcoholics to come to once a month, to Alina Lodge, where she is trustee and executive director. And I have seen and felt the admiration and the love shown her by her students, some of who are here today. I want to tell you, girls, they flock back to Alina Lodge on the second Tuesday of the month to see this woman who has given them so much. In many cases, she's given them back their lives. Jerry has been a source of inspiration to me personally for some years, and I have borrowed much of what she has said. But when I am there, I take copious notes. And I told her today, I wonder that I've used her words many, many times. Jerry came into the South Orange, New Jersey group in April of 1947 and has recently celebrated her 32nd anniversary. I present to you Jerry Delaney.
Thank you, Kitty. Good afternoon, girls. My name is Jerry Delaney, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Boy, that sounds good, because when I came into AA, there were two women I was three. I like this. Not that I don't like men, understand. I do. But I felt very lonely, and I would be remiss if I did not pay my respects to the families of the male alcoholics, the women who were so good to me in those days. And I couldn't be more grateful to them then, because to me, the family who prays together stays together, and the family who goes to AA together stays together. And in those days, this was a common thing. It was a family disease, but I didn't have the disease, and I want you to know that. I hope this afternoon that you'll listen with a good deal of tolerance, which allows me my opinion and you yours. Now, if you believe all those things that Kitty tells you, you will think I'm something extra special. And in fact, I am sober today by the grace of God in AA. And that's as far as it goes. Anything else that I'm able to do that will contribute to the sobriety of another alcoholic is the only thing that counts as far as I'm concerned. When I come to one of these conventions, I'm a little bit like Tommy Mandrell's fifth wife. I know what's expected of me, but there isn't any new and unusual way to deliver. I never feel that I'm among strangers at an AA convention or meeting, because strangers are friends we just haven't met yet. And every day, all over the world, when I'm privileged to travel, I find friends in AA. And if we want to find another AA, let me tell you, we can do it. If you haven't got any place else to find one, call the police department. They always know. They've been very good to me, by the way. You know, when I arrived in AA, I thought I was a very special person. And really, I didn't need it. It was my brother. I had gotten him in AA 38 years ago, and he needed it. He was a moral leper. And he neglected his family. Terrible thing. I didn't neglect mine. I didn't have a family to neglect. I wasn't even married. But I sure did a job on his. Number two, he had to borrow money from me. And I was always doling money out to him. Oh, the marker sticking out all over me. I had plenty of money to spend at that time. I traveled on an unlimited expense account, and I was the auditor, which made Bert Lance look like Pink Tea. As far as I know, they've never caught up with me, but I'm not going to question it, you better believe. Most of them are dead. There's only one or two of them left. They'll all be dead eventually, and then I won't have to worry. They were neighbors of the first water, too. And I'll tell you a little bit more about them later. And number three, my brother had been in jail. And nobody in my family had been in jail. Well, of course, they were closet drinkers. Verna was a society dame who drank anything in sight, and the doctor came over to get her off of it so she could go to the country club for lunch. Guess what he used to get her off the booze? Heroin. The new drug on the market. Oh, lovely thing. And I had never been in jail. Why, my brother was put in jail for leaving the scene of an accident. I never did anything like that. Well, you know how you wake up in the morning and you look out the window and to see if your car is all right. And the side facing the window wasn't there. Of course, I don't know where I left it to this day, but I didn't get in jail. You know that. I wasn't like you. And I called a child psychiatrist, which I think today is pretty appropriate because we're pretty childlike. And I called a child psychiatrist and asked him what to do about my brother who drank too much, and he didn't know either, but he did know a man by the name of Bill W. And there was another man out in Maplewood, and he couldn't think of his name, but he'd call him up and see what he could do. And Bill and one other man went to call on my brother. And thanks be to God, he died a couple of years ago, still sober. He learned his AA lesson well because he didn't try to sober me up. Those closest to us seemed to be able to do the least. And so he did not bother trying to help me. I can remember sitting in his kitchen with a full glass in my hand and saying, "You don't think I'm an alcoholic, do you?" And if he'd have said yes, he'd gotten the drink right in his face. He'd say, "No, dear, have a drink, go to bed." Hoping that I would die, and afraid I would, you know, because I was an only sister. Came the time, I always said that if I ever got in any trouble, now what I actually said under my breath, trouble I can't get out of. If I ever got in any trouble, I'd call my brother and ask him if he could help me. I had no intention of ever getting in that kind of trouble. But there came a morning, after a year of revolving door in the hospital. You see, I worked for the medical profession. I was stationed at the Mayo Clinic. And the head neuropsychiatrist told me I wasn't an alcoholic. And he gave me elixir terpenhydrate. He gave me elixir phenobarbital. He gave me Swedish massage. He gave me whirlpool bath. And when I was going to convention, I said, "Phil, can I have a drink?" And he said, "Sure, Jerry, but keep it down to one or two." But he forgot to say whether it was 1 quart, 1 gallon. I came back by ambulance from Cincinnati, Ohio, to the Mayo Clinic, and to this day, he can't figure out what happened to me. I had been having, the revolving door had just been awful. During that time, I had been found unconscious in the Statler in Boston by a very famous child specialist. And he ran to the telephone to call the ambulance because there was no pulse. And my secretary was there and said, "Oh, don't bother. She'll be all right in a few minutes. She gets like this lots of times." And to show you what a neighbor's doctors can be, not intentionally, but accidentally, they had this little secretary whom I called Tea Kettle because she was nervous. I don't know why, working for me, why she'd be nervous, but I called her Tea Kettle, and they had Tea Kettle in the conference room, and Tea Kettle told all, and they fired her for disloyalty. Now that same doctor that saw me unconscious less than a year ago, when I was going to Boston to help with writing a history on this organization, wrote me a letter. He's 82 years old now. I'm not going to try to disabuse him of anything. He was a goal of mine. He wrote me a letter and he said, "I didn't tell Ben about your problems because you never were an alcoholic. You were outrageously overworked and underpaid. So I want you to know I'm not an alcoholic. But I'll do until one comes along." And there might be a few in this room coming along. But they didn't mean to nearly kill me. But they did. You know, in my day, phenobarbital was legal and alcohol was illegal. You carried around a few phenobarbital in your pocket and you threw in a couple in case you got nervous. And I was always nervous. They had started me on it at age 17 because I was, and they have such nice names for things now, you know. They call them hyperkinetic children. In my day, they called me an honored little rat. And I think that was probably right. It did quiet me down, but it didn't do for me what alcohol did. Alcohol had a very special tinge because at age 24, I tried some bathtub gin. Now, most of you in this room don't know what bathtub gin is, but it's straight alcohol cut with water, little juniper berry, little orange peel, and aged 15 minutes, and you drink it preferably in hard cider. And I tried that first night, and I can draw you a picture of the apartment in Chicago where I took it. Where had this wonderful stuff been all my life, and what? Why had I been such a prude? And I never was again. Because my life from then on was occupied with finding out where I was going to get the next drink. Not the next pill. I always had plenty of those. Because I picked out the best psychiatrist in every city. I traveled with this pediatric board giving examinations. I was in fine state to give examinations. But I traveled with them, and I would call up the leading psychiatrist in the city, tell them who I was, not what I was, but who I was. And they would always see me, and this was to ensure a backup in case I got bombed out. I know this now, but I did not know it then. I have learned everything I know about myself in AA. And don't ever forget, I didn't really know this. I was so busy feeling comfortable and staying out of trouble that I wasn't bothered with the whys. I was just bothered with the hows. How do I get enough to keep me comfortable? And so I had plenty of medication, and it doesn't smell in the morning. And there was always something new coming on the market, and we had a standing joke in the office where a great many doctors had a sample closet. We say we try the new medicine on Jerry. If it doesn't kill her, it won't hurt the patient. We thought that was very funny. It almost killed me. So after mixing these up for quite a few years, I drank for 15, I took medication for 19. One morning I waked up, looked up to see it was my ceiling. Wasn't my ceiling. I looked over to the right, and there were bars on the window. Weren't bars on my apartment. Looked over to the left, there were nurses flitting up and down the hall. And I made a very brilliant deduction. I was in a nut factory. And that's exactly where I was. On the west side of Chicago, they had put me there to get me out of the limelight. It seemed that I was not very acceptable in the community. Being noisy and hitting the papers and so forth. So they had put me over there. And up until that time, my brother in AA, I just couldn't tolerate that religious fanatic. And after all, this holy roller thing, I'd been to these meetings, and they were always praying and saying some prayer to help them, and I didn't see any point in that. God helps those who help themselves, and I wasn't helping myself, so why should I bother the Lord? But that morning I felt differently about it. And as I put my clothes on to stagger out in the hall to see what I could find out, I said to myself, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to ask my brother if he'll help me. That's probably the first honest request I ever made of the Lord after I started to drink. Miracles were all miracles. That was my first miracle. That, in retrospect, I know, was my spiritual awakening. But I didn't recognize it as such for a couple of years. But 20 minutes after I made this statement out loud to no one but myself, he stepped off the elevator in that nut factory in Chicago. He'd been called on many occasions when they said they didn't think I'd live through the night, because the combination of these drugs and alcohol is pretty lethal. But I always say now, the Lord didn't want me and the devil couldn't use me. And I think that's the trouble right now. So he stepped off of that elevator, and he didn't say, "Can't you see what a louse you are," or anything, or "Why don't you do it like I do?" He said, "Honey, your life's in a pretty lousy mess. Do you want to do something about it?" And I did, but I didn't want that holy roller to help me. But I didn't say that out loud. I said, "Well, I guess so." He said, "We'll go back east." And we flew back, and we were grounded in Allentown, of all places. Allentown is my nemesis, apparently. And had to come down over those hills of New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and I was used to flatland with a hangover and no medication and no booze. And he was a college professor, and I had to sit in the lobby of a hotel while he taught a class. And if I ever want to keep my ego down, I'd always been pretty successful with the men, give or take a little. I went in the ladies' room. I needed a drink so badly, and I thought, well, I'll fix myself up, you know, and I'll catch a drink in the bar. I took one look and thought, nope, that isn't successful either. Soft eyes, stringy hair. I weighed 104 pounds soaking wet. My dress looked like I'd been sleeping in it 6 months. I gave that up and I sat there and sweat. And he took me to his home. My sister-in-law didn't want me very badly. I'm not sure just why. And that is the biggest lie in the book. I had supported her, yes, but I'd made her pay through the nose for every dime that I gave her. But she did let me in. And I did start going to meetings. Now, my brother did not take me to meetings. He knew a girl in AA by the name of Helen Dunnett. God rest her soul. Great, big, raw bone woman. And she came to see me, and she took me to meetings. She and another Helen, who was, we celebrated our 32nd anniversary together recently. And they came to see me, and they started taking me to meetings. Now, meetings were a little different than they are now. They didn't say, dear, would you like to go to this meeting or that meeting? They said, get up out of bed, we're taking you to a meeting. I don't want to go to a meeting, I don't feel good. Who asked you if you felt good? Get up. And if I didn't get up, they reached over and dragged me up. And I went to meetings against my will. And I thought, I'll learn this thing. And I'll learn the whole thing. And I'm smart enough. And then I can go back to Chicago and join my friends and drink like a lady. And I went to meetings like mad with these folks. And again, a few people began to come in to AA. And one of them was a little gal that spoke Thursday night at the lodge. Many of you know her, Kitty R. Kitty's got the worst language I ever saw. Helen and I were going to clean it up. 6 months later, we were swearing worse than she was. I'm still trying to break myself of the habit of not doing very good, but with this tape machine going, I don't know how good their bleeper is. So I'll try to keep trying to clean it up. But Kitty's still talking like she always was. And as I say, I haven't improved a whole lot either. But we went to meetings and the groups began to get more gals. That first year, I thought I was doing a fine job. You know something? I remember almost nothing of that first job, first year. After coming into AA in April, we formed a new group in November. My name is on the charter. I don't ever even remember being there. I'm the only survivor that founded it, so I go to the meetings every year. But I tell them this because it takes a long time to get the anesthetic out of our head. You know that little recording equipment up there? It's a little bit like some of these tape recorders that have got a weak battery in them. And it doesn't come back just because we stop drinking. You say, do you have blackouts? I don't think. I don't know whether you call them blackouts or not. I don't care what you call them. But I would go and I couldn't remember things. I had no recall on certain areas. And so I started carrying notebooks. And you know, I still carry a notebook and I still make notes and I still use them because you know there's nothing new under the sun. Everything I have to say to you, I've heard from another AA people, young or old. All I'm doing is putting it in the context of my life, which may hit one person, and if it does, I'm very grateful. The second year, by the way, I began to realize the second year that there was something missing up here. And I began to worry about screws. And it wasn't tacked down too tight, I'll have to admit. And I went to my friend Ruth Fox, the psychiatrist in New York, to ask her about why I couldn't remember the people I went to grade school with. And she looked at me. She said, "Cherry, are you working?" "Yes." "Are you doing a good job?" And I said, "I think so." "Are you learning anything new?" "Yeah." "Are you able to recall what you learned?" "Yes." She said, "Then why don't you stop worrying about what you don't know and worry about what you better learn?" She said, "You know, it takes 2 years to get your brains out of hock and 3 more to get them unscrambled." And I thought she was an idiot. But she's right. As far as I'm concerned, what I say is my own opinion and not necessarily that of this group. And you can take what you want and let what you don't want go. As I began to clear up, I began to find out I was a pretty average alcoholic. Not anything special. Oh, I thought I was. I was a kid, you know. I was the medical hot shot, and I knew everything. And I began to find out how little I knew, and maybe that's what I was supposed to do, was find out how little I knew. I found out I was about average. I had had the resistance. Drinking? Why me? It's not me. And then when I got sober, I said, "Why me?" And you know, today I still say, "Why me?" To be so fortunate. To be kept alive after overdose after overdose after overdose. It must be to carry the message. And so, to this day, I have never refused to carry the message if I'm physically able to do it. I found out that I was addicted. Oh, terrible thing. I didn't take any hard drugs. Let me tell you something about these hard drugs. If they come from a good place and they're not dirty, they don't last as long as Valium, Librium, and you know what. Everything that I had. They're not nearly as lethal as that. But I didn't like that word, addicted. And then I began to use the dictionary, and I urge all of you who are new to use the dictionary and look up Mr. Webster's short stories. They're very interesting. And you look up addicted, and in its simplest form, it's pain plus a learned relief. I had pain, not physical pain, emotional pain, spiritual pain. And I learned the relief because alcohol gave me a peculiar euphoria that it doesn't give the so-called earth people. And so I was addicted to that which gave me the relief. Whether it be liquid or solid, your body could care less. Whether it's liquid, solid, prescribed over the counter, under the counter, snuffed up your nose, stuck in your vein, didn't make any difference. The body is looking for a relief from the pain. And yet we say this drug will be different. It will be. It'll be worse. That's why it'll be. It's rugged. But I finally realized, yes, I am addicted. What am I going to do about it? When I sobered up, I had pain, didn't I? The pain I had before I started to drink, plus the remorse, the guilt, the regret. Because I lost that beautiful job with the doctors. They came and told me they'd pay me for a year, and at the end of the year I should come back and talk to them. And in my alcoholic arrogance, I told them what they could do with their job, and they did it. And I was most surprised because I didn't think they could live without me. They've lived very nicely. It did cause them some problems because I had a lot of stuff up here. You know, we don't just exactly put things down on paper. But what was I going to do about my addiction? And somebody suggested to me that I had to become addicted to something else. And I can report to you today that I am addicted. I am addicted to the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous. and may I never lose this addiction. Because the day I do, I'm a dead duck. It doesn't make any difference whether I've been sober 1 year, 1 day, 1 month, or 32 years as I have been. If I forget for 1 day, 1 hour, 1 minute, what the addictive substances will do to me. And alcohol is the most commonly used. I will be dead. There won't be any doubt about that. I have seen it happen. Unfortunately, the Lord has given me quite a few lessons about this. Even though alcohol had interfered with my life, you know, I had the usual urge to get married. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder about it. I love men, but, you know, I wonder why I have to make honest men out of all of them. But I met a man in AA, and I married him because, you know, if you were married to an alcoholic, that'd be better, wouldn't it? I got news for you. A marriage is a marriage is a marriage. The miracle is that we live in the same house with some of the men without children. And we don't want to live without them, do we? Okay, then we have to learn to get along with them. And I married an alcoholic who, unfortunately, after 18 years, got bored with AA. And he decided he couldn't understand why I went to all those meetings. Well, you know the end of the story. He drank again. He died of an esophageal hemorrhage after having been Mr. AA in New Jersey. He taught me something. It was very hard for me to take. But it taught me that I don't have to drink anymore unless I want to. Am I going to not suffer? No. How would I know I was happy if I were never sad? How would I know why I was up if I was never down? How would I know I could handle trouble if I never had any? And that was wonderful for me to learn. And let me tell you something. I had talked to families before then, and I had said the right things, girl. Not sure I believed them, but you better believe I believe them now. And it has made me a better teacher. For this I am grateful. Out of everything sad comes something good. Alcohol had interfered with my life, and I can allow other things to interfere with my life to such an extent that I will forget about my needed treatment. And I do need treatment. I do not believe that stopping drinking is enough for us. It is the first step and something we must absolutely do. You know, I can't imagine starting controlled drinking. The last 5 years was controlled drinking. Most miserable drinking I ever had in my life. I would drink and come off of one and stay sober for 4 months, 5 months, then reward myself. When I say, see these articles on controlled drinking, I simply say to everybody that asks me about it, the normal drinker doesn't have to control his drinking. And if he does, they better stop before I get him, and that's the worst thing I can think of to say to him. I'm the toughest in the treatment field, by the way, in case no one told you. I get the reluctant recovery when everybody else has tried and they've failed. You come to me, and you'd rather get well than come see me again. I don't let heart patients lie on the ground, and I don't let anybody else, and I don't in AA. If people ask me a question, they better want the honest answer, because I'm going to give them an answer as I see it. Is it right? I don't know. But it's worked for me, and all I can do is tell you what's happened to me and what's good for me. If you want to take it, fine. If you don't, the same way. So what have I done in my growth? I have learned that there are no instant cures for any of my problems. I'm not saying that you can never have any medication at all. But the only time you have it is when addiction is preferable to the problem that will result of not taking the medication, like epilepsy or like heart disease or something of this sort. And I've had major surgery since I got sober. And after the surgery, refused painkillers, and I didn't suffer any more than anyone else. And I had the experience of being terribly nervous after Novocaine. And so I've been able to pass it on to someone else. Anything that changes our thinking from straight line, we're playing Russian roulette, and I personally can't afford it. So I have to realize that there are no instant cures, and as Pearl Bailey says, we have to use what we have to get where we want to go and then conserve it. Don't slip back. Hold on to what you have today and wait until it's time for you to move up another notch. The guy that scales the mountain rests, sometimes in between on a plateau. But he never looks back. He goes forward. The only thing I look back for is to see the stop signs where I don't want to go again. If I'm going to stay sober, I have to find some sort of a balance in my life. You know, God gives the birds food, but he doesn't put it in their mouth. So I have to go out and find those things which will help me. Where do I find them? I find them in meetings. I find them in going to hospitals. I find it in talking to other people. I find it in writing letters to friends. I have to go out, but a letter may help someone else. But it helps me more when I'm trying to help them than it'll ever help them. I'm not expecting the reward that I always expected before. I have the reward on the day that I write it. A feeling, a nice warm feeling down inside of me. Through my growth, I have come to the point where I don't need the compliments anymore. You know why? If I get a nice warm feeling down inside of me, that's all I deserve and probably all I'm going to get. You know, most of the time. Do we get the things back from those that we've done for? Almost never, once in a while. But not as often. But we get it from unexpected places. I never expected to have the privilege of being in Akron. And as a founder's day. And it's come back to me. And I love being here. Just the thought of being in Akron. Of course, I had a little bit of an expectancy gap, and incidentally, girls, the expectancy gap in life is pretty rough. And I expected to be in here last night, and I expected to do a lot of things, but it doesn't always work out that way, and I think we have to think a little bit about being like the guy that all his life had had a little golden screw in his belly button, and it bothered him. And he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, oh, we'll fix that. He said, I'll give you a pill, and you'll go to sleep tonight, and you'll dream about it, and you'll dream about where the golden screwdriver is, and you get the golden screwdriver, and you unscrew it, and your screw will be gone. Oh, he was delighted, and found the golden screwdriver, unscrewed it, but there was only one problem. His can fell off. So if you expect too much, you might get something that you don't expect. And mine fell off in Pittsburgh last night, and I almost didn't get over here, and I was being very unhappy. But thanks to Dottie and her husband and Kitty, I got over here to have one of the greatest thrills of my life of being here today. As I go along trying to get a balance in my life, I have to get a balance between getting and giving. You know, I think all of us like to give. I like to give. I think of the child, though, that gives you a little bouquet of dandelions or weeds and you want to give him $1 to go to the movies, don't do it. Learn, kids, to accept from other people the kindness that they want to give you. This is one of the hard things for me. I always want to do twice in return. But I ruin the gift of the giver. And I must remember that. This is very hard for me. It was very hard for me to say just a simple thank you. Somebody said, my, that's a nice dress you have on. Oh, this all right, and I might have just spent my bottom dollar trying to get it. It's very hard for us to learn to do simple things. You know another thing that AA has taught me to do? I could always give to men. That was easy. But I had never been able to express my gratitude to women, to go up and kiss a friend or throw my arms around them, or just reach over and touch them. AA has taught me that. And it's been a real joy, because when you get to be 72 years old like I am, there are not very many men. I have to get some balance between acquiring knowledge and using it. You know, there's so much junk. I cleaned that up in a hurry. So much junk coming out on the market today, and so many things, all knowledge, you just knowledge right up to your eyeballs. And you're not using a bit of it. You know, if you can't get the knowledge that's up here down to your heart and use it, it isn't worth the powder and shot to blow it to hell. That 18 inches is a real fur piece. And it isn't any good unless you do, and I recommend that you better use what you've already got. And keep it simple. I used to think if they didn't say, tell me to keep the cork in a bottle and go to meetings and shut up, I'd kill them. And then, you know, being single when I came in and the kiss, I liked that. But then when a stupid part came in, I didn't care about it too much, that keep it simple, stupid. I didn't care about that too much. I wanted to be selective, and now I have learned in AA to consider things and see if this applies to me today. You know, sometimes it may not apply to me today, but may apply next week. This is one reason why I take notes. I've got cards and notes and things scribbled all over everything, all over the house. But you know, if I get upset and reach over, there's something to underline that'll help me change my thinking. And you know, this is very important, because a split second may make the difference. A half an hour might make the difference. I keep telephone numbers. They told me to get 6 day numbers and 6 night numbers, because the day numbers and the night numbers aren't the same, and besides, 11 of them might not be home. We were great on using what was then nickel therapy. But you spent an awful lot on your booze. If you're like I am, I didn't get too much of it furnished me. But I had to fight for every step of the way, and for this I'm glad. I had to learn to get a balance between work and play. You know, we get to be workaholics, and that's pretty rough. First thing you know, we're beating the drum and working all the time and running the AA meetings, and what's happening to the family? They're falling to pieces right under our nose. And you say, well, they ought to be glad I'm sober. Getting sober is what you should have done in the first place. Anything after that. But I have to be very careful to get some balance. Now, what is play? Do I have to go out and play golf? You know, that isn't play for me. That'd be work. The only time I went out on the golf course on my honeymoon with a new set of clubs and topped the ball 3 times, turned to the caddy and said, "Would you like a nice set of clubs?" And he said, "You mean these?" Because they had been given to me. And I said, "Yes." And I've never been on the golf course again, except to ride in a cart and look at the scenery out in Honolulu. I never expect to be again, if I can help it. I have to get a balance between comfort and discomfort. I know that I'm going to be uncomfortable because I'm going to do things that I shouldn't. I'm supposed to finish this in 60 minutes and I don't know what time it started. That's the way it goes. Maybe somebody will stick their fingers up and tell me. So that's the kind of thing that makes you uncomfortable. But you know something? I've learned to talk about it. You go to the psychiatrist for $75, he'll say, "Verbalize here." And that's a nice idea, but I just wish you'd just say, "Talk about it," and let it go at that. I had to learn about words. You know, there are an awful lot of words coming on the market now that are thrown around. I didn't like the word insane. Who's insane? And yet Webster says, insanity is not whole, not normal. And I wasn't whole, and I wasn't normal. And every once in a while, I'm not whole, and I'm not normal. And if I'm not, I began to look at me. The word depression that we girls throw around. Oh, dear. Oh, I'm so depressed. I'm in the menopause. Wonder what the men have when they get depressed. Menopause is highly overrated, and depression is nothing in the world except unresolved discontent. You're discontented and you're too lazy to get up off your butt and do something about it. Criticism is not always bad. People try to help us by pointing out where we're heading into trouble. And let's try to be grateful, too. Last but not least, you better continue to take your inventory. You know, it's all right to take it once, and I'll tell you, if I was still operating on the first inventory I took, that'd be pretty tough. But I have to take a full-scale written inventory at least once a year, and oftener if I'm in trouble with me. And when I get uncomfortable, I'm doing something wrong. It isn't what you say. You can't do anything to me that I don't let you. So I urge you to take your inventory. And I urge you to go to somebody and talk about it. An interested but unaffected party. These steps are progressive. Their effect is progressive. Just like our drinking was progressive. But let's use the positive thing and use the step. Of course, I wanted faith. You know, I wanted it like lightning. Everybody does. And I'm a little bit like the little boy who wanted a God that he could touch. Don't we always want one that we can touch? Let me tell you something. Every day in the recovered alcoholic, you can touch your God. Because it's a miracle that you see every single day around you. And whatever you do, don't keep on, don't stop trying. Don't ever stop trying on yourself or on someone else. Now by trying, do I mean that you go and call on somebody time after time when they get drunk? No, but you can get somebody else to do it. Don't get too proud and think that you're the only one in the world who can help them. Because maybe there's somebody else that would say exactly the same thing you do in another language. Every once in a while I have family say to me, but I said all that to them. And they did. But the wheel that squeaks the loudest gets the grease. And you know something? Maybe somebody else can make it squeak louder. I can't help but think of a little story that Sam Thompson of the Los Angeles Times told about her. I think this is a story that her father told her about two frogs who fell in a dish of cream. And one frog swam around for a while, then said to his friend, I'm too tired, I'm going to quit. And of course, he drowned. The other frog kept on swimming. He went past the point of exhaustion, as we often do with an alcoholic. But you know something? The cream began to turn to butter. And so the frog was saved. The last few lines of the little song that they sing about this said he climbed upon a lump of grease and there he floated with the greatest of ease. And so we can if we keep on kicking, but we must do it. And whatever you do, keep your prayers simple. Don't ask for things. Give thanks for things. Priest friend of mine, I said, well, Father John, I don't see any use in going to church. I don't happen to be Roman, but I said, I don't see any point in going to church. I said, he said, what do you go to church for? Well, I said, to ask God for help. He said, you ever try being like it would be if your neighbor gave you a pie, and it was a good pie, and you ate it, and you washed the pie plate, and you went back, gave it to her. You didn't say that was a good pie, but give me two the next time. You say, thank you very much. Maybe you better go to church and ask the God of your understanding, or get down on your knees, or go out in the yard and look up at the sky. I don't care where you pray. Where you talk to the God of your understanding, it doesn't make any difference. But believe you me, your great big beautiful brain didn't give you what you have today. Something that you can't understand gave us this beautiful and gorgeous program. And so each night, I ask God to take my hand. It's much better this way, I know. Because if I take his, instead of his taking mine, I might get afraid and let go. May this never happen. That I should let go of God or this program or the lovely people that I'm meeting today. Thank you very much.
Jerry, what a marvelous experience it has been, primarily to have Jerry here with us at Founders Day this year. And selfishly, from a personal aspect, some of my family was not really expecting to leave for Pittsburgh at 5:30 this morning, but he did willingly. We are very grateful to have had the additional special time with Jerry. So many things she has said to us today are simple. Spade is a spade type. And to me, that is straight AA, no watered down hogwash, and it is just great. Thank you so much, Jerry.